ensure availability and sustainable management of water and sanitation for all. Each of these SDGs are supplied with 9 and 8 targets, respectively. Add to that, the two goals are supplied with more than 40 indicators. And which are our aims with this series? Well, here are some. Enabling integrated approaches to SDG implementation by bringing together a range of stakeholders to accelerate progress towards the goals. Identifying ways to exploit positive interactions and mitigate trade-offs. Forging multi-stakeholder coalitions behind programs of accelerated action. Identifying good practices for empowering communities, sectoral actors, and cross-sectoral alliances at multiple levels. Promoting the establishment of communities of practice that will continue to collaborate in the lead up to the SDG summit and beyond, and bringing the concept of nature-based solutions to the SDGs. And friends, not to forget, there are in all 17 goals, 169 targets and 234 indicators. And these numbers speak to the interlinked and integrated nature of all SDGs. With growing awareness of the complexity of this world, there is an understanding of interlinkages growing exponentially from the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972, which established UNEP, through the UN report Our Common Future in 1987, when the concept of sustainable development was firmly placed on the global agenda, through Agenda 21 and the 27 RIA principles in 1992, through the establishment of the MDGs in 2003, and to the agreement of the SDGs in 2015. And the more we dip into the SDGs and their implementation, the more convincing an interlinked implementation becomes, a message we should bring to the SDG summit in September. The two SDGs today are on water and gender, and we'll hear more about that from our experts. But let's just look into the issue briefly. Water covers 70% of our planet. 97% of this is salt water. 3% is freshwater, and even less. About 1.2% of freshwater is drinking water, and even less is clean water, and even less again is accessible and affordable water for all. In March this year, the UN will organize the midterm comprehensive review of the International Decade for Action, Water for Sustainable Development. The organizers state simply today, the world is not on track to achieve SDG 6 and related goals by target and targets by 2030. And they continue to state the following: water is inextricably linked to the three pillars of sustainable development, and it integrates social, cultural, economic, and political values. It is cross-cutting and underpins the achievement of many SDGs through close linkages with climate, energy, cities, the environment, food security, poverty, gender equality, and health. With climate change profoundly affecting our economies, societies, and the environment, water is indeed the biggest deal breaker to achieve the internationally agreed water-related goals and targets, including those contained in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. If you read the 2030 document, you'd find that there are some interesting pieces of information I'd like to give you. A significant qualifier is added to today's SDGs, the word all. SDG 5 is about all women and all girls. All is used 175 times in the 2030 agenda document. The concept by 2030 is used 61 times, and equal and equality are together used 40 times. But saying this again and again does not make it real. UNDP published a gender norm index 2 years ago. Based on research covering 80% of the global population, its findings were shocking. 91% of men and 86% of women held at least one bias against women in relations to politics, economics, education, violence, or reproductive rights. Almost half of people feel men are superior political leaders. More than 40% believe men make better business executives. Almost a third of men and women think it's acceptable for a man to beat his wife. In June 2020, the Equal Measures 2030 Partnerships found that no country was on track to achieve gender equality by 2030. We are not all equal yet. Will we be by 2030? And we seem to be facing mounting challenges amid global crises that grow in numbers, complexity, and severity. Less than a month ago, we relegated 2020 to 2022 to the archives of history. We all wished that this year, 2023, would be better than the one we finally left behind. And yet, on top of all the crises that relate to sustainable development, to the environment and to nature, we are faced with a troubled political crisis, which has manifested itself in a war fought in Ukraine, but which is a war waged by an authoritarian state against democracy, justice, free speech and liberty for all. Alas, this brutal war is not the only one today. There are more than 50 armed conflicts raging today, brutally killing innocent people and devastating the environment. Writes the Global Peace Index, the economic impact of violence on the global economy in 2021 was equivalent to 10% of the world's economic activity, the GDP. Thus, we use 10% of the global GDP for destruction, in which we seem to excel. And 3-4% of the global GDP is the estimated cost to implement the entire 2030 agenda, in which we do not excel. Where did our priorities go wrong? As a good friend recently wrote in her keynote statement at the Sustainable Development Transformation Forum organized last October, and I quote, "All these crises have been caused by human actions. And as we have acted wrongly, it is in our hands to act in a better way and create the best world. By acting forcefully, we can turn these crises into opportunities." And that is also the nature of the SDGs, a tool that can be used by all in turning crises into opportunities. Let's hear what we have to say and discuss today. Thank you for your attention.
Jan Gustaf, thank you very much for those introductory comments. And I would now like to introduce our next speaker, who joins us a little bit at the last minute, but we greatly appreciate the fact that she has stepped in. Maria Mercedes Curi is with the United Nations International Federation of Youth for Water and Climate. And Maria, you have the floor. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles. It is a pleasure for me to be joining you in the session today. I would like first to pass my apologies from my colleague, Kisaya Gerosano. She is currently in mission and her connection is unstable, so I will be taking her place. So my name is Maria Mercedes Curi, and I'm a young water professional from Argentina, currently serving as a regional focal point for Latin America at the United International Federation of Youth for Water and Climate, shorter UNIFI. So UNIFI is the official youth constituency for the World Meteorological Organization and the Water and Climate Coalition. First of all, I would like to thank you for giving us this space, and I would like to use it to bring the voices of young people, young women from across the world into this virtual discussion table. So at UNIFI, we have conducted a large-scale survey to try to understand which are the perceptions of young people regarding water and climate challenges. And of course, the gender dimension is constantly underlying the results that we got. So I would like first to tell you about three items that our respondents have strongly agreed upon. So first of all, most of our respondents agreed on the lack of education in water and climate topics, which in the case of young women and girls can have multiple impacts, from the increasing their likelihood to be exposed to waterborne diseases to the lack of opportunities to reach leadership roles in the water sector. Also, young people have agreed that there is an insufficiency in the resources targeted at what is disaster risk reduction and loss and damage. And this is specifically relevant for in this conversation, because we know that women and children are most vulnerable in the aftermath of disasters, and not just in terms of health, but also security as well. And finally, young people have also agreed that water governance fails to bridge the gap between decision makers and the most affected peoples. And these are just a few. So at UNIFI, we have prepared a set of commitments that are youth proposed and that are ready to be adopted as commitments as part of the Water Action Agenda, which will be the main result from the historic UN Water Conference taking place in March. And I would like to highlight three key goals that underline these commitments that we have came up with as a movement. So first of all, we want to secure youth representation. So as a movement, we launched a campaign called 30-30-30, which is asking for 30% of representation from people under 30 by 2030 across multiple levels of decision-making and action. Second, we are asking for a strengthened multi-stakeholder, cross-sectoral and equitable water governance and management. And third, I would like to mention that we are also pushing to foster collaboration among youth groups and youth networks with other non-youth stakeholders. So bringing this last idea, I would like to finish by highlighting the need to account for the interlinkages between SDG 5 and 6. And I would like to encourage you then to reach out to young people and to all these networks that we have established so as to hear about our experiences from the ground, which might enable you to dig even deeper into these interlinkages. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Maria. I think Charles may have a problem with his connection there.
Sorry about that, David. Okay, David, I was just going to, I apologize, I didn't unmute myself, so please forgive me for that. Just a quick word to say thank you to Maria for stepping in, and please extend our thanks to your colleague, Kizia, for bringing you along to us. Now, David, the floor is yours now. I would just like a question to you, David. Would you, after you have your comments, do you want it to be a gallery view, or would you want the panelists to come in one at a time until the Q&A?
Just before we get to that, we have one other keynote, Dr. Nina Lansbury, who will speak on SDG 6 before we move to the roundtable.
Nina, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you, David, and a beautiful opening there by Maria. So my name's Nina Lansbury. I'm calling in from Australia on the East Coast. Mianjin is the language name for the traditional owners of this land. I'm also known as Brisbane in Queensland. So I'm a public health researcher, and I look at climate change and remote Indigenous communities in Australia, although I'm a non-Indigenous Australian. And I'm sitting here in Australia, a very wealthy country, and I've been asked to talk about the interlinkages with SDG 6 and the other goals. And I guess the headline messages are that despite our wealth and privilege in this country, SDG 6 is not yet achieved. And I'll tell you why in a moment. And the other headline message is that these interlinkages, understanding them is really an important way to avoid unintended consequences, negative consequences. And so bringing in a systems thinking where those connections between each of the goals are understood and known is important. As we only have 5 minutes each to speak, I thought I would put my comments into a story. So I'm sitting here with the background photo from a small island at the very north of Australia called Waterbear. It's in the Torres Strait, and the people who live in the Torres Strait, the traditional owners, are Torres Strait Islander peoples, different to the Aboriginal peoples, of which there's around 250 different language groups, but there's about five different language groups up in the Torres Strait. And the Torres Strait population are very proud people, but very much a minority. So 3% of the Australian population are Indigenous, of the whole of the Australian population. And of that 3%, 8% are Torres Strait Islander people. So they are physically remote, they are politically remote, and they are a minority of a minority. And yet, if you look up the Torres Strait Islands, you will see that that is where climate change impacts are being seen and felt and heard. So in terms of SDG 6, thinking about, I'm going to just focus on the drinking water aspect. This is a sand island. And for the thousands of years that Torres Strait Islander people have lived on Waterbear, on this sand island, there has been a freshwater lens that has been beneath the surface. And that's been the source of safe and reliable drinking water. However, with sea level rise, that freshwater lens has now become inundated by salt. So that now requires desalination. So the response has been to desalinate the freshwater that's now salt contaminated. But that requires diesel fuel, so a form of petrol, that comes in by barge, by ship. And this is a tropical zone. So then that can be disrupted during cyclones. And another dimension is that because the water is being desalinated, it needs a storage facility. So there's been a large open air storage facility developed. However, an unanticipated outcome was that the migratory birds that were on other islands, but never on this island, now come and sit on this large water storage area. And there's fecal contamination from the birds into this water storage area. So that's a physical setting, but we've got this overlay of being remote, being Indigenous, and that has huge political consequences, and as well as high level of financial and political disadvantage. And you've also got water operators who are very isolated from peers. So if we think about interlinkages just at the goal level, we're sitting here thinking about number six, but we're bringing in aspects of health, so number three, aspects of climate action, number 13, and aspects of poverty, number one. So just to leave you on, well, where are we now? What's happening in this situation? Thinking about how is SDG 6 going to be achieved? There are community-led solutions so that all the options on the table are actually community-oriented, which means that they're going to be appropriate culturally, appropriate for that community, and that is going to build in a sustainability of the initiatives. The water operators are much more supported from the mainland, from the larger organisations. The energy source for desalinating water is being considered from renewable energy options. There's an increase in the understanding of public health and the role that water operators in managing the water treatment and water desalination, that they actually are a highly responsible professional who provides a public health role, a preventative health role on the islands. And behind all this is a respect of being in a colonised country, and that remaining on traditional country, if that is what the traditional owners prefer, needs to be upheld after over 200 years of colonisation. And so if we go back to those interlinkages with the SDGs, yes, we're still sitting with number six, but we've brought in number seven around renewable energy. We brought in number 10, which is about inequalities. We brought in number 11, which is about sustainable communities. And then we've also brought in number 17, which is about partnerships. So I wanted to leave you with a more positive angle on how these interlinkages need to be understood, but the outcomes actually by having that systems thinking approach of how all those dimensions are interlinked can actually result in a very sustainable a set of initiatives to take the future forward to ensure safe water and sanitation for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nina. That was really excellent, a great example and of systems thinking and a collaborative approach to a very concrete problem in Australia related to SDG 6. I'd also like to thank the previous speakers for their valuable comments, Maria and Jan Gustaf as well. And now on behalf of Stakeholder Forum, I'd like to welcome everyone to our discussion of SDGs 5 and 6. We have six excellent speakers for this discussion. As in previous webinars, first, each speaker will discuss their recommendations on ways we could better account for interlinkages in implementation. This will be followed then by questions from the audience. As mentioned earlier, please submit your questions in the Q&A section. To allow as much time as possible at the end for Q&A, I will now briefly introduce the speakers to everyone. First, you will hear from a leader and expert on gender and climate-related issues, Ms. Carmen Capriles, founding member of Ria Sun Climatica, and co-chair of the Global Facilitator Women's Major Group for UNEA/UNA. Second, we are delighted to have with us radiologist and social entrepreneur, Mr. Innocent Menu, team leader and co-founder of MScan. Our third speaker is a water scientist and expert on developing tools to support Nexus approaches. That is Dr. Grace Olewusaya, senior researcher in water, climate, and gender at the United Nations Institutes for Water, Environment, and Health. Fourth, we have an expert on water interlinkages and the SDGs at regional level, Dr. Ali Karnib, senior water and sustainable development expert. Our fifth speaker is a renowned author and experienced writer on water-related issues for the UN, Ms. Marisha Wojciechowska Shibuya, lead author of UNSCAD's final report on water and sanitation, and author and publisher of my Globetrotter book. And to finish off, we will hear from a youth leader on water diplomacy and multi-level governance, Ms. Tove Lexen, Program Officer of International Policy at the Swedish Water House. We are very grateful to have you all here, and we look forward to your contributions. I would now like to give the floor to Ms. Carmen Capriles. We will be very grateful for your recommendations on how to enable integrated approaches.
Hello, good morning. I want to greet everybody from La Paz, Bolivia. Actually, my situation is basically the contrary of Nina's, because I live in a landlocked country. I live in the middle of the Andes. And I want to share a little bit about my experience with the MDGs and the SDGs around gender issues, climate change issues, and water issues. Since I live in a landlocked country, our situation is not that we're so isolated, but in a sort of way, we are. The big problem is that we cannot access, for example, the ocean. So in that sense, we don't get to interact with the ocean in order to get rains. So most of our, and also because of the altitude that we have, most of our water is going to come from the melting of the glaciers. So that's why for us, it's important to fight against climate change, because climate change, especially global warming, are melting faster than the Andean glaciers. So in the last 30 years, we have lost almost 50% of the Andean glaciers. And we already experienced a period of drought during one of the Niñas, because this phenomena that happens in South America because of the Pacific. And that has have a great impact on water disponibility. And what we have seen, we had to live like 90 days without water in a big city like La Paz City. So, but these are the effects of climate change that are directly linked with water. So where does gender fit there? Well, we know that climate change exacerbates inequalities. And we know that worldwide, we haven't achieved that equality among men and women that we would like to, especially in rural areas and especially in developing countries. Why? Because we still have a very big gap in education, for example, in access to health systems, in access to migration possibilities, in access to income possibilities, in access to land. And we have seen that in the global north and in the global south. So for us, it's important to make that relationship that how climate change has a disaggregated impact among men and women. So that's why it's important that we focus on SDG 5 in order to empower women, but also in SDG 13 in order to take urgent action to climate change to change this situation that, as I mentioned, is happening worldwide. And it's more clear when we are speaking on rural communities in developing countries. For example, here in the Andes, not so far from my city, you can see communities that used to depend on the glaciers, on the water. And once the glacier was gone, they didn't have the water source. So they had to shift their economic activities to new ones in order to be able to generate the income that they need and the livelihood that they need. So in that sense, it's important to carry on policies that can tackle climate change, that can also take care of water issues and mainstream gender issues. In the case of water and sanitation, for example, although Bolivia was one of the countries that proposed water and sanitation as a human right in 2010, we have only achieved like 60% of sanitation in the country and less than 80% of access to water. And those are very bad statistics compared to our neighbors. And it's been really hard to translate SDG 6 into real policies that can reach the whole country, because we are a very difficult country in ecological and social political terms. So at the point of like talking about the implementation of the SDGs, those are the things that we have to take into account. In the case of gender specifically, and having worked in 2005 in the assessment of civil society for what was at that time the MDGs, the development, the Millennium Development Goals, the goals around mortality, mother-child mortality, were really game changers for a country like Bolivia. And we had lots of cooperation because of the MDG agenda, the MDGs, and that has helped shift the current and reduce our index of health and mortality. And I think that's what's happening right now with the, that's why I have dedicated so much time as a volunteer to contribute on the drafting of the SDGs and on the implementation of the SDGs and the Agenda 2030 in order to create and to see that game changing in countries like mine. Unfortunately, after 7-8 years of the Agenda 2030, we're not seeing that game change that we expected. We have found a really good excuse in COVID for not achieving the SDGs. And I think that is not good. We need more political will from all the countries around the world in order to achieve the SDGs and not to use COVID, keep using COVID as excuse for why we're not going forward in developing issues, and especially in sustainable development issues. So that would be kind of like my global short analysis, and I'm open to any question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carmen, especially it was interesting, your example echoed what Nina was saying earlier, but in the case of landlocked countries. And I think an important message is how we can use integrated approaches to empower vulnerable groups, particularly, and reduce their vulnerabilities particularly in the context of growing emerging crises and other disasters. So thank you very much for that. I will now give the floor to Mr. Innocent Manu. We would love to hear your thoughts on linkages to account for when implementing Goal 5. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dr. David. My name is Innocent Menyo, calling in from Uganda, and I greet everyone on the call. Mine is more of a pragmatic approach or a solution to addressing some of the issues around SDG 5 gender equality, but also showing the interlinkage that it has with SDG 3, that's good health and well-being. It's quite clear that disparities still exist in sexual and reproductive health that overly hinder progress to SDG 5. And these disparities, among other things, must be addressed if you are to succeed at SDG 5. And for sure, we cannot talk about gender equality when we still lose over 16 mothers for the case in Uganda due to avoidable and manageable risk factors of maternal health. With simple reason, from my experience, among others, we've seen the lack of basic diagnostics like ultrasound scan machines. And when I was training so many years back as a medical student, I saw so many mothers die due to risk factors of maternal health because, you know, there was no that, you know, simple ultrasound to be done for them to see maybe a placenta previa or amniotic fluid low levels during pregnancy. So I do believe that attention must be paid between this close interlinkage between SDG 5 and SDG 3. In light of the works I do at MSCAN in rural Uganda and Kenya, we are empowering women through making pregnancy a worthwhile experience in effort to contribute to SDG 5. With our innovation, we've developed portable ultrasound machines that work on laptops, tablets, and these are very power efficient and they're very, very low cost to fit into low resource settings. We've scanned over 4,000 women, detected over 50% complications, and refer these mothers for timely interventions. And because our devices are 5 times cheaper than the traditional ultrasound machines, we've cut costs in rural clinics. You know, the clinics would spend lots of money on big power consuming machines, but you're cutting down these costs. And in the long run, we are reducing the out-of-pocket expenses for mothers in that regard. At the same time, we are leveling the play field for women in key grassroots positions in diagnostics. We currently train midwives in point of care ultrasound, empowering them with equal opportunities as men. And after training, we usually deploy our innovated portable ultrasound machines, which I believe is rather a pragmatic solution to addressing the SDGs. As is known for our fact in Uganda and Africa, women contribute significantly to the GDP, especially through agriculture. Yet some energetic men are very passive at this in rural communities. So I believe as we innovate, we really, really have to pay a lot of attention to the women, especially sexual and reproductive health, like SDG 5 talks about, leaving no woman and girl behind. Such innovative solutions like MSCAN that level ground for good health for women have demonstrated significant impact with key contribution to gender equality and in the long run contribution to economic development at grassroots. I want to end by saying that by addressing issues around maternal health, inclusive technologies are bridging this gap that exists between men and women in Africa. And my recommendations would be two. One, in countries like Uganda, still afar in achieving universal health coverage and medical insurance coverage, innovation has a key part to play to reduce out-of-pocket expenses for basics such as diagnostics like ultrasound for pregnant mothers. And with this effort, we believe maybe we might have, we might have some contribution to SDG 5 and 3 as we draw closer to 2030. And the other recommendation is that policymakers must know that a lot of cultural hurdles still exist at grassroots. And this is quite unbelievable for those that perhaps have not worked in the spaces we do, but in my experience in low resource settings, there is a lot of cultural hurdles that we usually maneuver through. And that's why we've come up with training women all the way from the bottom to address such disparities. So we do train point of care ultrasound, and we encourage more midwives to come into such positions of power, such positions of influence, even at the grassroots. So policymakers have to pay a lot of attention at the grassroots. And overall, last mile delivery must be strengthened for a more inclusive and fair discussion of SDG 5 and its interlinkages with SDGs like SDG 3. MSCAN, save a mother, save a life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Innocent, and for reminding us of the importance of accounting for linkages between 3, 4, and 5 and for including women in all aspects of the process of technological change. Thank you very much for that. I will now give the floor to Dr. Grace Olewasaya. We look forward to your recommendations on policies and tools to support holistic approaches to implementation.
All right. Good afternoon, good day, everyone. And thank you for having me. I'm Grace Olewasaya from the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment and Health based in Canada. I've been invited to speak on the SDG 5 and 6 interlinkages and how to accelerate the implementation. So with that, I believe the main question will be, how can we promote gender equality for effective safe water and sanitation provisions to accelerate those SDG agendas? My response to that will be, as water is central to human development, gender equality is critical to safe water and sanitation provision. In other words, SDG 5 is central to accelerating SDG 6. We need to get that very clear. The next logical question then will be, how can we accelerate SDG 5 to accelerate SDG 6? Before I go into that, I would like to set the scene as well and start with these well understood or accepted facts. I'll throw a few out here. That women are stewards of water at the household level, I believe is a common knowledge. We all know that. Again, that women are underrepresented in leadership and decision-making roles, despite making up nearly half of the world's population. Many of the speakers that have, you know, talked ahead, you know, before me had, you know, throw up some light into others, is a well-known fact. That all these trends now continue, despite many calls for action, for gender mainstreaming and other public policy measures that clearly affirm the equal rights of men and women, and officially integrate gender perspectives in legislation, in research, resource allocation, project management and monitoring, to mention a few. For decades now, that's where the issue lies. Why have these not galvanized into equitable power sharing in the water sector, at least? So for us, I believe, the solution lies in true representation. We need to understand there has to be true representation. That word representation is a powerful word with deep meaning, particularly when seen through the lens of human development. So empowering women as water managers, as truly as they are anyway, is not an act of benevolence. True representation should be seen by all as a right, and of course, as a tool to realize global good for all. But how do we actualize true representation? The tool to galvanize this is true gendered statistics. So, what is gendered statistics? Gender statistics is capturing gender disaggregated data to better understand the gender inequalities. And this is crucial to the women and water agenda and already foreseeing a rethink of inclusivity. Evidence of gender gaps through appropriate quantification will help push for the much needed better inclusivity, particularly in the water sector. To date, many studies have attempted quantification of women's representation in the water sector on varying scales. A good example would be the IBNet 2015 that assessed about 222 water utilities and found barely 24.5 women in that sector. World Bank attempted a similar research and assessed, I think, about 64 utilities and found about 17.7% of women. Even at that, a data set that samples the full population of women in the water sector across the globe does not exist as at this moment that we're talking about. So for us at UNU INWE, we've been trying to focus on that gap, the way forward in integrating SDG 5 and SDG 6. We are quantifying women's representation in the water sector at the national and regional levels, starting with the Global South. For this to happen, we have designed a short survey to collect data on several specific indicators, largely stemming from the UNESCO WWAP toolkit on sex disaggregated water data. The data sets that will result from this initiative, we believe, will provide quantitative insight into the degree to which women are represented across the water sector. Our thinking, if we push the statistics out, it will help galvanize the needed representation. So for us, quantifying the number of women is a great first step in increasing women's representation. But we know it doesn't stop there. It will still require another layer of quantification, particularly if you want to ensure women's inclusivity in leadership positions. So this will be an impact evaluation assessment, for instance, on the role of women. So those 17% of women, those 24% of women that are already there in the water sector doing their stuff, we need to shine the light on their efforts, on their role, and the impact this is having on the sector and beyond. We believe both these routes will offer the needed opportunities for scaling up better inclusivity, and we really push or accelerate SDG 5 that will eventually also accelerate SDG 6. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Grace, and for highlighting the importance of meaningful participation in water governance as a way to account for linkages between SDG 5 and SDG 6. And in particular, the role of that data can play in doing that. Okay, I will now pass the floor to Dr. Ali Karnib. In light of your recent research on water and its interlinkages with other SDGs, we would be grateful for your recommendation.
Thank you, Dr. David. Thank you for all the speakers before me and also for the organizers of this interesting webinar. My talk, it will be in three rapid access. I will introduce the interlinkages firstly. Then I will give some examples of the interlinkage between SDG 6 and the SDGs. And I will conclude with how to account for the interlinkages. Let me start with the introduction to the interlinkages. Achieving SDG 6 actually provides a unique opportunity to accelerate progress on all 2030 agenda, due to the central role of water in advancing human rights, reducing poverty and inequality, and enabling peace and sustainability. So, and the linkages actually between SDG 6 and the other SDGs may be considered as either, firstly, supportive. Here we are talking about synergies. Secondly, conflicting, and here we are talking about trade-offs. And also, it could be neutral. There is no interlinkage at all. So informing about these interlinkages will enable policymakers to manage synergies and conflicts between policies engaged to achieve the SDGs. I have to mention also an important remark that the context of policy options are crucial for determining the nature and extent of interactions between the SDGs. Now, let me give you some examples. I will give examples of synergies between SDG 6 and other SDGs. I will select some SDGs to go rapidly. We don't have the time. And then I will give you some conflicting relationship between SDG 6 and the other SDGs. Starting with the synergies, we can, for example, the synergy with SDG 1, no poverty. You know that improving access to clean water and sanitation can reduce poverty by increasing productivity and reducing healthcare costs. Synergy, for example, synergy with SDG 2, zero hunger. Improved water management can increase agricultural productivity and food security. Synergy with SDG 3, for example, good health and well-being. Access to clean water and sanitation is essential for good health and well-being. Additionally, providing access to clean water and sanitation can help to prevent the spread of diseases and promote good hygiene. So we have actually close supportive interlinkages between water and all the SDGs. I have a list of 17 SDGs, and I can assure you that with all SDGs, we have this close relationship and these close supportive interlinkages from SDG 6 towards the other SDGs. However, since I'm originate from the Arab region, and you know this, the Arab region is one of the most scarce in water, that facing water scarcity in the world. And here, let me give you that also there exists a conflicting relationships or interlinkages between the SDG 6 and the other SDGs and some of the other SDGs. Here, I would give you an example, like for example, the trade-off with SDG 13, climate change, climate action. In countries suffering from severe water scarcity, drinking water depends basically on desalination, which is fossil energy intensive. In this context, SDG 6 is in conflict with SDG 13 in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Also, there's a trade-off with SDG 14, life below water. Within the same context of water scarcity, the heavily concentrated brine solution discharged into the sea from the desalination plant has the potential to kill marine organisms and cause damage to the marine population. So in addition, also we can mention that withdrawing water from rivers and lakes can have negative impacts on freshwater ecosystems and the species that depend on them. So as you can see, we have supportive, we have synergies from SDG 6 toward other SDGs, but also we have conflicting relationship and trade-offs towards the other SDGs. Now, I will conclude by how to account for the interlinkages. So actually, to account for these interlinkages and ensure that progress towards SDG 6 does not come at the expense of other SDGs, there are several recommendations that can be implemented. Firstly, integrated planning. This approach considers the interlinkages between SDGs and incorporates them into planning and decision-making process. The second tool, the stakeholder engagement. Engaging with a diverse group of stakeholders, including local communities, can help to ensure that the needs and perspectives of all those affected by water and sanitation programs are taken into account. Also, we can mention monitoring and evaluation. Regularly monitoring and evaluating progress toward SDG 6 and its interlinkages with other SDGs can help to identify trade-offs and opportunities for synergy. Partnerships between government, private sector, and civil society organization can be used to leverage resources and expertise to achieve SDG 6 and its interlinkages with other SDGs. Finally, I would mention also the tools, toolkits and guidelines such as the Water Energy Food Ecosystem Nexus approach can also be used to assist decision makers in identifying trade-offs and synergies between SDG 6 and the other SDGs. I will stop there and thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Ali, for that comprehensive overview of interlinkages and potential different types of solutions to address them. Last but not least, now I cede the floor to, there's two more speakers. Ms. Marisha Wojciechowska, the floor is now yours. In light of your experience with the UN on water assessments, we would be grateful for your contribution.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you to the previous speakers and to Stakeholder Forum for this opportunity. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I'm coming to you from snowy Montreal. We've just had a 25 centimeter snowstorm overnight, and it's still snowing, actually. So my name is Marisha Wojciechowska Shibuya. I am a consultant, an international consultant. I worked in the water space for almost two decades now. And so the lens through which I see the world of water is forged in large measure by my 15 years or so in Asia, based mainly in Tokyo and Bangkok, as well as through my work as coordinator of the UN Water Country Briefs, the lead writer of the UNSCAB final report. Some of you may not know what UNSCAB was, but UNSCAB operated between 2004 and 2015 The acronym actually is the UN Secretary General's Advisory Board on Water and Sanitation. And I've seen actually that we have one of the UNSCAB members here with us today, David Boies. I also now regularly still work a lot with my Japanese colleagues through the High Level Panel on Water and Disasters, as well as the Asia Pacific Water Forum. I was actually in the secretariat of the first Asia Pacific Water Summit. All this to say that I see the SDG 6 and the water world through this lens of high level policy work, which means probably I know far less than most of you out here on with us today. In the context of this webinar and thinking about the interlinkages between in SDG 6 and the other SDGs, what I can offer are two significant sort of events that have occurred in the past couple of years that I've been privy to collaborate with. The first one is the fourth Asia Pacific Water Summit that was held last April in Kumamoto, Japan. And despite, you know, terribly difficult circumstances, logistical circumstances for my Japanese colleagues, the summit was actually a resounding success by some measures. In the fact that 17 heads of states and governments and 19 ministers from across Asia and Pacific were in attendance. The fourth Asia Pacific Water Summit outputs issued the Kumamoto Declaration, which I'd invite you to have a look at if you're interested, as well as the Kumamoto Initiative pledged by the government of Japan. Both of these documents have focused and, you know, across the water, the different water spheres of, you know, food and irrigation, as well as you know, all of the different water related sanitation and water supply and all of these different spheres, as well as bringing a sharper focus perhaps on climate change, disasters, and water resource management. The Kumamoto Initiative specifically, which was pledged by the government of Japan at the summit, is an effort by the government, as far as I understand it, is an effort by the government of Japan to bring sharper focus on the use of data, science and technology in the tackling of water resource management. Of course, Japan's technological prowess and, underscore why they would bring an emphasis on this. As well, Japan, through the Kumamoto Initiative, has pledged 500 billion yen to support other countries, which is like 4 billion US dollars at the current yen, and let's all hope the yen increases so that it translates to even more money for the international community. The High-Level Panel on Water and Disasters is chaired by the former Prime Minister of Korea, Dr. Han Sang-soo, and is also a high-level policy mechanism through which member states and the likes of the Emperor of Japan. I failed to mention also that the UNSCAB was chaired by, at the time, it was the Crown Prince of the Netherlands, His Majesty the Crown Prince of the Netherlands, and the honorary chair was at the time the Crown Prince of Japan, both of whom now have have now taken on the role of King of the Netherlands and co-chair, therefore, of the upcoming UN Water Conference. And the Emperor of Japan, who was at the time the honorary chair of UNSCAB, and who still is present and makes speeches at the High-Level Panel on Water and Disasters. The High-Level Panel, its flagship event is a biennial conference called the UN Special Thematic Session on Water and Disasters. The next one, which will be held in New York on March 21st, just on the eve of the UN Water Conference, and to which both majesties are expected to participate, though has not been confirmed, as well as different heads of states. Of course, they are expecting also the president of Tajikistan as co-chair of the UN Water Conference. But don't hold me. Don't quote me.
No, thank you, Marisha. I think it's very useful to have that overview of the, you know, the governance structure in the Pacific Asia region, and, you know, interlinkages and the funding, the great support that Japan gives to that, and, you know, the discussing interlinkages and how to bring them into the policy. It's a topic that's quite difficult, and we're all grappling with. And I hope here today we have. You know, people will connect with you and connect that forum to some of the solutions and the methods that are here. And that's very much, you know, what Stakeholder Forum is about, connecting the global international policy forums with NGOs, ideas on the ground, stakeholders, who what we need is their involvement in order to account for all these different interactions. There's just so many, and it's extremely complex. So thank you very much for that contribution. And waiting very patiently has been Ms. Tove Lexen. Apologies for the delay. Given your engagements with the COP and the HLPF processes, we would love to hear your thoughts on ways to enable integrated approaches.
Thank you so much for having me and for organizing this very important event. So CW and Swedish Waterhouse, where I works with improving water governance and integrated approaches are at the core of what we do. We firmly believe that water is vital to reach most, if not all, the SDGs. Gender is one of our cross-cutting issues, together with youth and a human rights-based approach, and we therefore apply a gender lens to everything we do. I want to give you three examples from our engagements in water and climate, water diplomacy, and WASH. From the water and climate perspective, we think that it is crucial to raise women's participation in decision-making. This is because climate change has detrimental effects on gender equality from several perspectives, including, first, in many places, women lack access to platforms where information and data about climate change are shared. Therefore, women often have fewer opportunities to build preparedness and resilience to climate change effects, which aggravates already existing gender gaps. Second, women are more commonly caregivers and responsible for household duties. As climate change is predicted to increase drought and make freshwater sources less available, women and girls are more likely to have to spend more time fetching water from faraway resources, thereby making non-household related engagements, such as attending school, increasingly difficult. Third, women more commonly have occupations directly dependent on water, such as in washing and haircutting services, which provides them with an additional vulnerability to hydric-related climate change effect, a matter that in turn can decrease the possibilities of economic empowerment of women. For mentioned reasons, it is vital to increase the participation of women in decision-making bodies. This is an issue of enabling just inclusion and access, but also through women's additional gender-sensitive knowledge, crucial for identifying efficient and sustainable climate adaptation and water management measures. CW is one of the core leading organizations behind the Water Pavilion at the UN climate meetings, and one of the key elements of this arrangement is gender inclusion and gender balance in the event in the pavilion. Therefore, CW in its role as a convener makes efforts for inclusive decision-making. From the water and peace perspective, we think that including more women is crucial for success. CW works actively to increase the participation of women in water diplomacy, which has produced important lessons and insights. The Women in Water Diplomacy Network in Denial and the Sister Network in Central Asia and Afghanistan both serve as communities of practice for women water diplomats in fragile regions supported by CW. The networks are designed as track point 5 processes and largely include representatives of the ministries of water and foreign affairs and other related line ministries. The overarching objective of the networks are to support women's leadership in high-level decision-making in transboundary basins with a focus on gender and youth empowerment peer-to-peer learning, capacity development, research cooperation, and joint advocacy. The Women-Led Initiative has a track record of supporting inclusive representation and gender equality at all levels of transboundary water management, with positive implications for regional peace, human security, and good water governance. The network has demonstrated the importance of affording women in decision makers access and space to mentoring and knowledge exchange while fostering trust between key actors across the basin. Water and WASH have clear connections to gender. That also has to be deepened to be addressed more effectively. I have already spoken about access to decision-making in regard to climate and diplomacy, but of course this also applies to decision-making about WASH. While men usually are the ones deciding about the provision and location of WASH facilities, women are affected differently than men by these decisions. Feminist and minority approaches are needed to address inequalities in access to WASH. In regard to this, CV has a project about WASH in schools that is particularly interesting. As earlier exemplified, lack of household water provision can pose challenges for girls attending school. However, another important feature for enabling girls to go to school is provision of WASH, as recognized in SDG 4A, 6.1, and 6.2. WASH in schools is crucial for safe, nonviolent, inclusive, and effective learning environment. WASH in schools is particularly important for girls because of menstrual hygiene reasons, biological reasons, and societal norms related to dignity. Last year, CV and UNICEF wrote a report regarding WASH in schools in the building back from the COVID-19 pandemic. Short-term recommendations included installing equipment to ensure water availability on the premises, the continuing sharing of information, and dialogue with municipalities to guarantee that they ensure continuous service provision. Examples of long-term recommendations are to improve the coordination between the ministries of education and health to clarify their respective roles and responsibilities. These were the three perspectives I wanted to bring up about inclusive decision-making in climate, gender-sensitive water diplomacy, and gender-conscious planning in regard to WASH. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Toby. That was an excellent contribution and well thought out examples of how we can provide more meaningful representation in international decision-making policy processes across several different dimensions. And thank you very much for that. Charles, have we enough time for some Q&A? There's quite a few questions in the chat box.
Yeah, I would say, thank our friends for staying with us and those who are on the panel. If you're able to stay a few minutes, and for our guests, if they can stay a few minutes, I certainly recommend that we take some questions. We have some very good ones. I think we should honor the upvote. If you notice, the panelists, you should be able to go through the questions. And one that has the greatest number of upvotes, it has to do with the with children in Africa. And I'll read it, and with the hope that some of our panelists might have some comments. In Africa, 180,000 children under the age of 5 die each year, or about 500 per day in sub-Saharan Africa from diarrheal diseases attributable to the lack of water, sanitation, and hygiene, WASH services, said the United Nations Children's Fund. This terrible information comes from UNICEF. How is it possible to reduce the impact for the survival of young African children? Would anyone like to make some comments there? Please activate your microphones if you wish to comment. We have another question with an upvote. What are some of the persistent underlying causes of the much deepening gap between policy development and the implementation to achieve gender equality in water and sanitation provision and management? We also have a question about indigenous peoples. And this is something that Jan Gustav might be able to shed some light on in his expertise with stakeholder engagement. If I can Let me see if I can.
Sorry, Charles. Maybe I should provide a comment or two.
Please do.
Grace.
Go ahead, Grace.
Okay. I guess the overarching thing for me is to break it down to our local levels and to our daily realities. The issues with gender inequality, they are ingrained. It didn't just start now. And water, everybody is a water user. So we are all primary stakeholders in this. So bridging the gap, particularly want to flip the issue with the children or the integration and partnership that we're talking about. Let's take it all down to the grassroots. Women are managers. Water governance, they should be involved. I don't understand in the name of, okay, I'm a man, that pretty much maybe your cultural norms in local levels will not even allow you to be the one fetching water. Now taking it away from affluent nations now, back to developing countries where we have so many overarching cultural norms and practices that are just anti-women. There has to be an understanding, a recognition of true representation. At the local communities, allow women into water governance. They understand child care. They understand women care. They understand, in fact, the care of everyone. By the so-called societal responsibility or societal roles placed on women. Women are the carers. Integrate them in water governance at the local level so that they can prioritize, appropriate, allocate water appropriately at the household. It has to be bottom up. This is where we start. So when you see their function or appreciate their function and allow them at that local level, it will start to scale up. Now we'll need education for them, for their voice, to be able to sit at the table, for their voice to be heard at the table, as we now move through the ladder from that local level, household level, local level, community level, to, high up international, global policy levels where they can make an impact. So it's not so far-fetched. It's not unrealistic. Women are already doing this work. That's their role. My submission is allow women to take their place as water managers, to take over water governance. And let's see what happens. I know we have, of course, just barely 7 years to 2030. At individual level, in your household, every participant here, in your household, take this initiative and let's take it on. Everybody is a water user, but we can't keep relegating women in the name of all this inequality that we've been calling on for so long and allow a change. And I think Dr. Khalid, I think, that also lead the fact that water is central to human development. The same point I make. So if you want to see acceleration across board, include women in water governance from the local level to the top, you'll see changes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grace. Extremely important. Stakeholder engagement as a way to account for linkages, particularly at the local level and also for long-term plannings. We very much appreciate your contribution. Would anyone else, just looking at questions in the chat box, some interesting ones there about how can we advance integrated approaches when we don't have a legally binding agreement? What are people's views on how we can do this? I think it's quite a relevant question, but for all of the goals, which we can talk about the ones we have under review here at the moment. Is it leadership? Is it working together? Would anyone like to comment?
Thank you, Dr. David. I would like just to mention that I saw two questions related to my presentation. I will answer directly in this intervention, and also I would like to give some comments about the integrated approach and how institution should be also developed. I mean, this necessitates a coordination among different entities in the country, among different ministries. And the institutional aspect and governance aspect in integrating SDG 6 into the other SDGs is very, very crucial. It's not only about SDG 6, it's also about the whole SDG, the whole 2030 agenda. We need a coordination mechanism. We need a good governance in that. Now, back to the questions for me, particularly, one of the questions mentioned that if desalination is in conflicting with climate change and the goal, and also with the water with SDG 14 goal, so how to solve this? What are the solution for these types of conflicting issues? Of course, desalination is heavy fuel technology. Use technology. We need to go through more renewable energy in producing water in desalination. And here, research and science advances are important. We are relying on the technology in the future to use the renewable energy for desalination. And I can assure you that huge progress are already done in this topic. And we are actually looking for final solution for that. Another question was about the integrated approach. Actually, in the SDG 6, we have the integrated water resources management application in countries, the achievement of integrated water resources management. This is the SDG 6.5. So yes, I talked about not only the IWRM. We need much more higher than that. We need integrated planning. We have to put all the sectors together in a nexus approach. We need to bring all the sectors. We need to bring energy, food, ecosystem, and water, of course, into a nexus approach to evaluate and assess all the policy options, all the policy actions in one of these sectors, and to see how much this policy action is really beneficial for the other sectors. Not only for water, it could be beneficial for energy, it could be beneficial for ecosystem, and so on. So this is my answer to the second question. Thank you, David.
Marisha, you have your hand up, and so is Carmen. I don't know who was first. So.
Okay, thank you. Just to bounce off what Dr. Amil just mentioned, I think it's crucial. I think it's really our job as experts is to advocate for not only our sphere of the world, but also for us to demonstrate that there is these interlinkages are crucial. I mean, when you bring it back down to the national level or subnational level, budgets are strapped, and we have to be able to demonstrate that investing in one action, whether it's water supply or a wastewater treatment plant, has cascading benefits down the basin, down the society. And so I think these are it's very important to look at it in terms of the interlinkages and to be able to advocate and demonstrate that, you know, intervening in one SDG or on one sphere of society will have cascading benefits to other spheres in terms of poverty or food security or energy security.
Thank you, Marisha. Exactly. And engaging with stakeholders is a way of learning about what these cascading impacts are and redesigning the policy to make it better for sustainable development. Sorry, Carmen, please could you take the floor there, or would you like to add to that?
Yes, in the case of the MDGs, it was like a top-down approach. First world countries and UN will tell developing countries what to do. So we had a lot of criticism around that, because that's why the Agenda 2030 is global, and it has tried to have a bottom-up approach. But in the case of the MDGs, governments have to make the policies in order to implement the MDGs. What we are seeing in the SDGs is that you can contribute as a volunteer, you can contribute as a CSO, you can contribute from wherever you are, you can contribute to this agenda. But the thing is that if we don't have the policies, if we don't have the governments that are doing their job in order to have the grassroots or the civil society organizations doing their job, it's really very hard. So that's why we need to ask for accountability. That's why we have to ask for a more commitment, for more political will. And I know that we read the PNRs and we see countries that are doing spectacularly in paper, but we see that the reality is very different. So that's why we need civil society engage in this process to kind of like see what's happening on ground. And we need some kind of mechanism where we can really find the governments accountable for what they're saying, and not just paint everything beautiful and not just say we're going in the right way when we're not. So that's kind of like a self-critic for like everybody, but I think that's one of the bottlenecks that we have in order to achieve SDGs. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen.
David, I just would like to jump in for a moment. I think we should try to be disciplined and finish no later than 9:30. With that in mind, I know that others might have some comments, but there is one question that has eight up votes, and you know, people would like to hear about it, and it's something that I think certainly young Gustav can have some comments on, but also something that I think Carmen would, because of it's to do with Indigenous people, and the question is, how can Indigenous peoples and their communities participate and engaged in SDGs 5 and 6? You know, how can their contributions be acknowledged and recognized? Maybe a few words from you, Jan Gustav, and anyone else would like to jump in?
Well, certainly I think Carmen is more capable of answering this than I am. But from a formal point of view, engaging in the UN system is not that difficult, but it's important that Indigenous peoples are there. There are several venues into the UN through which one can access the entire number of SDGs. The SDGs allows for participation not only at the high level political forum, which takes place in New York every July, but also in regional conferences that are organized quite frequently. And not to forget the organizational hub and headquarters of the environment, which is across the Atlantic from New York. We tend to think about the SDGs only associated with New York. UNEP has a very strong role, not the least in water issues, of course, but also in governance issues. And they are also perhaps even more open to the involvement of Indigenous peoples and their massive and important knowledge on the ground. But any NGO and any system within civil society needs to understand the formalities of the UN. Sometimes it's a bit of a hassle, but this is where stakeholder form actually can help. But I would say that Indigenous people through the UN system have done very, very great things. Once they're there, they're listened to. Maybe Carmen would go on.
Thank you, young Gustav. Yes, Carmen, over to you.
Yes, I will talk about our experience. We did a study on 2019 around mercury on an Indigenous population, mercury that came from gold mining. And yeah, we found really high levels of mercury in this population that has nothing to do with mercury or with gold mining especially. And we were able to present this study in as a parallel event to one of the high-level political forums. And thanks to that, we were able to catch the attention on the rapporteur of Toxics, Marcos Orellana, who has put a lot of effort on calling the attention to Bolivian government in order to stop small mining, because this is not... It hasn't become an issue of minery versus environment. Now it's an issue about human rights, and that's happening in all the Amazonian with coal mining, and in other places with other toxic substances. And yeah, there are many barriers where indigenous people cannot get to these UN spaces. And mostly are like the same people that are coming and like repeating themselves. Of course, they have a very, when I say repeating doesn't mean that they're saying the same thing, but they have a very specific message. And I think we also need to see how to downscale all these decisions that we have and all these great ideas in order to get to these indigenous groups, and to kind of like understand these alternate ways of living that have survived in the case of the Amazonian since before the Inca Empire. So and they are going to be extinct within the next 20 years. So it is important to give this space to indigenous people. It is important to recognize their alternative ways of life, their ways of thinking. And we've been really very bad at incorporating that into the Agenda 2030 to see different points of view and alternate visions and cosmovisions. Unfortunately, the Agenda 2030 is very Western view based. And yeah, we hope that in the future we can keep on working to incorporate more these alternative ways of life and these alternative ways of seeing things that are not necessarily how we understand development. So that's kind of like a reflection, and it has a lot to talk about, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Carmen. Gustav, you want to make one final comment before I hand over to David?
Very, very quickly. I mean, when I so agree with what Carmen says here, and her example about mercury is very, very interesting, because when we talk about interrelationships and interlinkages of the SDGs, we tend to forget what the United Nations is also doing outside. And when we talk about legally binding measurements, there are, you know, and Carmen knows this probably much better than me, than the multilateral environmental agreements who have legal standing, and the civil society groups around mercury actually pushed through the Minamata Convention, which now is trying to regulate the use of mercury. And I also know that the Escazú Agreement, which was based on a lot of the issues that Carmen talks about, are issues to deal with. And what I'm trying to say is that, you know, let's not look at only the 2030 agenda, but also put it in the context of the normative issues and the legally binding issues that the UN is also working on, and use this to promote our positions. Thank you.
Thank you, our guru of interlinkages, Jan-Gustav Strandenes. David, I'd like to just give you a final word before I add some closing comments.
I just want to thank everyone for participating today and for all of your contributions and all the questions in the chat box were very interesting too. And I'll hand it back to you now, Charles, for the closing remarks. Charles, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. What I'd like to thank you all. What I would like to say is I'll make some closing comments. Our SF director, Irina Zubcevic, wasn't able to stay with us.
I'm actually still here.
Oh, you are still
here.
Sorry
about that.
Well, go ahead. Please, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Charles. And I'll be very brief because we are already running out of time. Just to thank all the wonderful speakers. I have learned so much. It was such a rich webinar. And to all the participants, I see that we had over 200 at one point. So this is great. Thank you all very much. I would like to really thank my colleagues, Jan-Gustav and Charles and David, who was moderating all of that. And just to say, I hope that we continue this enthusiasm that I have felt this morning at this webinar in the run-up to the SDG Summit, to which these webinars are contributing. And also to announce that the next webinar will be on the 22nd of February, and it will be on the SDG 8 on the sustainable energy, and SDG 7 on sustainable energy, and SDG 8 on economic growth, productive employment, and decent work. So I hope you will be with us again in a month's time, and I wish you all the best, and do continue your good work, because we need all of you to be able to implement the Sustainable Development Goals and the 2030 Agenda. Thank you so much. And Charles, if you want to conclude the webinar, thank you.
Irina, thank you so very much. Yeah, I think it's time to wrap things up now. As you see on your screen, of course, we have the next event coming up in February. We also have another event, but I'll just make my closing remarks. I'll leave the screen up rather than say too much about it. Thank to everyone for joining us today. And a huge thanks to David Horan, Jan Gustav Strandenaes, and in particular, thanks to our expert panel for delivering today's rich and thoughtful content from different time zones around the world, especially those with personal intimate knowledge of the subject on the ground. Grace gave some impassioned remarks from her personal experience, which is something that these events are really meant to bring to the international community. In addition, as you see, the stakeholder forum team will prepare a summary of this and future webinars as input to the United Nations SDG Summit in 2023. And lastly, we'll hope you join us next month for the fourth in our series, the Countdown to SDG Summit 2023, which, as Irina said, will be on the 22nd of February. We'll send out joining instructions for that soon. And lastly, as you see on your screen, please consider joining us next week at the when we have a side event, a virtual side event in the sidelines of the 2023 ECOSAC Partnership Forum. Our delegation will be there, and we hope that you'll join us for that. In the meantime, you'll get copies of these recording, or link, I should say, to this recording from the Zoom platform tomorrow morning. And on that note, thank you all very much for joining us. Please be safe, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.